Hi, this is Miguel Gulen. Welcome to another Around the Corner podcast. Today is Sunday, June 22nd, 2008. This particular recording was made at the Texas CTO conference that took place June 2008. Actually, it was sometime last week. I don't remember the exact dates. I had the opportunity to sit in with a lot of other chief technology officers, although I am a lowly director of instructional technology, and catch a presentation, or really it was a panel conversation, between Mark Strama, Appropriations Select Committee on Education member, Representative Rob Eisler, the chair of the Public Education Committee, and Representative Scott Hochberg, vice chair for the Higher and Public Education Finance Select Committee. They were there chatting about a vision for education technology in Texas, the legislative landscape, and the session was facilitated by Dr. Alice Owen from Irving Independent School District, and the timekeeper was Ed Zients from Round Rock ISD, both of them being CTOs for their respective districts. It was a fun conversation. I have to admit that I found myself laughing at some of the remarks that the representatives made. And there were some really fascinating questions asked by folks in the audience, including Julie Lindsay from Birdville ISD. You'll get a chance to listen to this. I had the good fortune to be located right underneath a speaker with my iRiver T10, so I was able to have pretty good sound quality on the recording. There are some really powerful lessons or takeaways from this presentation. I think the one that everybody walked away from and was remarking on later, that technology, there is no value added by it in schools, and that the focus is really on accountability and data analysis and not so much on the instructional technology component. A lot of people, you could feel a little bit of the tension in the room as Scott Hochberg made these points, and you could feel that he was really sort of throwing the challenge out there. Some of the other points that were made were that chief technology officers and the folks that are practicing instructional technology in schools really haven't made their case for selling how the technology is going to be used. And, I think everybody agreed with that to a certain degree, but there was also a bit of skepticism as to whether, you know, that claim was really entirely valid. I think we all play a part in some of the problems that and the lack of recognition that technology plays in public schools. And it's difficult to just knock it down to a few sound bites or things. But it still made for an interesting conversation that morning. Without further ado, let's jump right into their panel conversation. Please feel free to leave some comments. I want to remind you that I did manage to take notes on the entire presentation. I didn't quite catch every single word that was said or every question that was asked. So, of course, the audio is critical for capturing that. I'm grateful to the Texas CTO Clinic organizers, especially Alice and Ed and the rest of the Texas CTO Clinic organizers, as well as Katy Independent School District for hosting the event. It was just a wonderful conference. And if you haven't been or weren't planning on going in the future, I do want to encourage you to go.
An executive of City of Houston, based in his hometown of the Woodlands, right here in the Houston Metro. We also have Representative Scott Hochberg, who is the vice chair of the Higher Public Education Finance and Select Committee. Scott has represented Southwest Houston in the Texas House of Representatives since 1993. And finally, we have Representative Mark Strama, who is part of the Select Committee on Education. And Mark is a native Houstonian and was elected to the Texas House of Representatives in 2004.
So with that, I'll turn it back over to Alice. Thank you, guys.
We will give you a chance to correct those if we have some wrong information about you. We are very pleased and just very excited to have this distinguished panel with us today, and really appreciate them donating their time to come and talk with this important topic today. The title of the presentation, we've called it A Vision for Education Technology in Texas, the Legislative Landscape. And Representative Eisler, Representative Hochberg, and Representative Strama are here to talk to you about their visions for technology and the challenges that the legislature faces. We have a process that we're going to follow today about our legislative panel. And so to keep the process going, we're going to give each panel member a chance to answer some questions that our group came up with at first. We have a few general questions that they're going to discuss. If this prompts some dialogue among the three of you, that's great. I do have Ed up here in the front. He's our timekeeper, so if somebody gets long-winded, he's going to remind you with some timesheets that your time is about up. But hopefully we'll keep the dialogue going and the conversation around these several questions. But toward the end of the hour, we're going to open it up to the audience, and we will have a microphone being passed around. So if you have some questions that you would like to ask the representatives, please be thinking of those now and have those ready towards the end of the hour. We will open that up to the audience. So first of all, we're going to start off with just the first question to each of the panel members. We'd like for you to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself as a legislator, maybe some bills you've worked on, or where your interests lie in the legislature. And start with Representative Strama.
Okay. My name is Mark Strama. I am actually not a member of the Appropriations Select Committee on Education. I desperately wish that I were. I tried to tell these two guys if I were, I could control the purse strings over everything they do. The truth is, these are the two most important members of the legislature on education issues. And they're also a great model of bipartisanship, one Republican, one Democrat, chair and vice chair of the Public Ed Committee, and that committee has received a lot of commendation in the past year for really moving past some of the partisan stalemate that we've had on education issues in recent history and advancing a bipartisan agenda. I am not a member of that committee. I desperately want to be. They both know it, and hopefully that's going to happen for me someday. I think I'm here because Alice and Ed both know of my particular interest in technology and education. And that interest actually stems from my business background. In the mid-90s, I was a political activist working at a nonprofit organization called Rock the Vote to get young people engaged in politics through MTV and the music industry. And in 1996, I was a relatively late adopter in my generation of the internet. I wasn't an early believer. In the early 90s, I just didn't buy in. I was not unlike Bill Gates, who in 1994 called the internet a big, slow, boring shopping mall. And I kind of thought so too. But in 1996, while at Rock the Vote, I had the idea to do an 800 number where people could call and register to vote over the phone using an interactive voice response unit. And in raising money for it, we found a lot more interest among sponsors, corporate sponsors, for funding a website where people could just fill the voter registration form out themselves online. So we ended up creating the first website where you could register to vote online. And my attitude at the time was, not many people are going to do it because everybody who's online is already educated and affluent and probably already registered to vote. Well, without a lick of promotion, we had 40,000 people register to vote in 6 weeks. And if you've ever done a voter registration drive and know how many pairs of shoes you would wear out going door to door the traditional way of registering voters, 40,000 people without lifting a finger in 6 weeks is extraordinary and opened my eyes to the power of this technology. So I actually left Rock the Vote, started a company that commercialized that technology and made it available to any website that wanted to register their users to vote. In the 2000 election cycle, 700,000 Americans used that technology to register to vote. which is to say that at the age of 32, I had registered more voters than Jesse Jackson. And I hadn't done anywhere near the hard work he had done to do it. That is the power of technology. And it blows me away. When I look at public schools today, and I see the extraordinary new challenges they face as class sizes grow, as the diversity and needs of the student population grow, one of the ways I think we can address those great challenges is by leveraging the power of technology that in every other aspect of society has revolutionized the way we do business in ways that have reduced costs and increased productivity and empowered end users. I think it is one of the critical things we need to do to meet the challenges of the 21st century classroom, to unleash the power of technology in those classrooms.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Scott Hochberg. I represent Galton and Sharpstown. So if there's HISD people here or ALEAF people, you may be any constituents at all. There you go. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. Well, you're close by. I've served on most every education committee we've had in the House for the last however many years since 1993 when I came aboard. And in real life, in my spare time when I'm not doing legislative stuff, I am a computer software developer by trade. I'm an electrical engineer by training. I was such a good electrical engineer that I became a politician. And now write in a couple of products that essentially sell themselves on the internet while I'm off indulging my hobby, which is legislation. So I have a real interest in both education and in technology. We're going to have a question about agenda and such, so I'll leave that till later, but that is probably why I'm on this panel. In terms of legislation, I've sponsored directly related to technology issues. I was co-sponsor on the original virtual school pilot, the Senate Bill 975 pilot that HISD made a lot of use of. And that's sort of unfortunately been backwatered by TEA and is sort of sitting back there without a lot of attention to it.
It's been virtually ignored.
It's been virtually ignored. And with that, I will pass the baton to my chairman, Rob Eisner, who always has something clever to say.
I guess it is on. Yes, I'm Rob Eisler, and it's an honor to work with these gentlemen. Fresh ideas, energy, and probably most importantly, very intelligent. And that's right, brown rice and French. Sounds like a menu, doesn't it? Okay. As I said, I'm Rob Eisler. I live in the Woodlands, I guess, for the past 29 years. Had the great opportunity to degree in architecture, but a draft number of 10. So we have to sometimes make decisions along the way. So having learned to fly in the Navy and then a short stint as a Continental pilot, I was furloughed and I'm still on the Continental shelf. that's not brand new.
Seriously, folks.
But I've always been interested in education. I've spent 18 years on the Conroe ISD Board of Trustees, coached youth sports, mostly basketball, for 20 years, 13 years as a junior achievement teacher. So I spent some time in the classroom and probably a lot of time in the policy business, local and I guess in the last 6 years more in the state realm. And, you know, I've always been intrigued with technology ever since, I found out the real time, the blinking 12 on your VCR. And I see that as a big difference back then because our biggest problem was teachers weren't used to technology. When you look at the culture, I had a good friend in the Navy. Do you remember when we sold the F-14s to Iran? And, of course, everybody said, what if they turn them against us? Oh, that'll never happen. Right? Well, this guy's job was to train the Iranian pilots the systems for, you know, F-14 inertial navigation system, radar, things like that. And these are people that weren't exactly technology proficient. So they basically had to start from the ground up with these students. In fact, he kept referring to them as the migranians, because he had a few challenges in the classroom. But, you know, by the way, the way you keep them from attacking us with our own weaponry is you stop selling them spare parts. And that's what happened. And I'm sure those F-14s are buried in the sand along with some other hardware. But anyway, education is a passion. And now those kids that grew up, by the way, are Army people, were very proficient in weapons, because weapon systems today are nothing more than video games that have real results. And our kids handle them very well, because they've grown up with it. And our teachers now are those kids that were exposed to that. So I see an acceleration in the absorption and progress of technology in the class, but also in education. So I think we're looking good in that area, because there's a fresh approach, and the youth are taking over. We stayed busy with some bills, and what Scott didn't tell you is probably one of the most important bills that we did pass was his bill, House Bill 188, that that turned textbooks into instructional materials. And that's 4.5% of $25 billion annually, which is what, 1.1125, something like that, billion dollars. And just even if in the traditional textbook purchasing cycle, and by the way, also in that bill were quicker adoptions, because technology is changing so quickly, and the technology will become eligible for that funding. So I know that's an important part. In fact, I had a meeting with some of the publishers at the beginning of the session. I said, your money is safe this session, which was last session, but I think it'll be in play next session. So hopefully we see publishers looking to adapt very quickly. We also looked at neuroscience-based reading as a pilot, math intervention, technology assessment bill for eighth graders, and again, we did have a virtual school bill pass, but as Scott mentioned, it's mired in some red tape. That's a good excuse, isn't it? But we've already been talking to some nicer than others to TEA about their response to legislative initiatives and bills. So we will continue that dialogue, in fact, in the very near future. As soon as we get Scott's schedule, we will have another meeting. And also another big initiative, and one that is growing and starting to take shape, not only in the reflection of our dropout situation and problems, is career and technical education. And somebody has told me that we're going to change that term again. I'm not sure what it is, but you know what I'm talking about. So I see the role of technology not only in its use for educating kids, but as a means, or as an end with those means, growing in importance. So we're in the right place at the right time.
That's all I have to say.
And we're already off schedule, Ed, so will you help us keep us on track? Our first question for the panelists, and we're going to start with Representative Hochberg for this question. Talk a little bit about your vision for technology in Texas schools over the next 5 years.
Okay, well, that presumes that any of us up here have vision at all.
You're the only one with glasses.
Over a five-year time frame. We're an unusual legislature in that we only meet once every 2 years. That actually gives us a two-year planning cycle, whereas most states have one. These days, I'm kind of glad we only meet every 2 years. We meet 140 days every 2 years. That was a typo in the original Constitution. Y'all should know that. If you took Texas history, you might know that. It was supposed to be 2 days every 140 years. We make the most of it. Let me talk about a variety of issues, and Chairman Eisler has been kind and foolish enough to assign me a couple of subcommittees dealing specifically with technology issues. We actually merged two. One was sort of a data subcommittee, and the other was sort of an instructional technology subcommittee. And I think we're going to hold the hearings jointly, at least to start out with. I kind of divide technology in the schools into those two areas. One, instructional, what you put in the classroom, some of the stuff that Mark was talking about, and the other, which I perceive takes a lot of y'all's time, which is what I call compliance and accountability technology. The other side of it, the stuff that's not in the classroom at all, or rarely makes its way to the classroom. In terms of instructional technology in the classroom, I think the jury's still out on what it is we ought to be doing there. We have spent now 3 years studying a laptop immersion project where we have, it was supposed to be a very carefully designed project. Anybody in here participating in laptop immersion either as a study school or a control school? Partially, okay. After 3 years and three consecutive studies of providing laptop immersion in primarily the middle grades and comparing that to similarly situated schools, similar demographic schools, without the laptop package. The results were very similar to what the gentleman was speaking about before we got up here. Lots of smiles, lots of happy teachers, lots of happy kids, absolutely no value added demonstrated on any metric that we use to measure student performance. That means to me one of two things. Either it delivers absolutely no additional value added in terms of student learning, or we've got a crummy metric. There are a lot of people at a lot of these schools who will tell you that the TOCS test is a lousy way to measure education. But at this point, that's all we have. And so we're comparing, and I will tell you that in my view, this wasn't even a fair test. Because what we did was take about a $1,500 laptop package and compare it with zero additional resources going into the classrooms in the control schools. We didn't say, what else could you do with $1,500? Because, frankly, we don't have $1,500 additional per kid times 4 million. We don't have it. So, I personally am not excited about going forward with that unless we figure out some different paradigm to measure. Something else to do, something different to do. But there was, at least in the last report, a real interesting finding that is at best preliminary, but I think is similar to findings that we're seeing around the country, which is that the key may not be, can you put a laptop on every desk in a classroom, but can be, and this again goes to what Mark said, can you make sure that every student has availability of a computer at home and access to the internet at home in a high-speed manner? And that might mean more than actually putting 30 laptops in every classroom. That leads to a very different kind of program. But that's one I'd certainly like to test. It kind of reminds me as a kid of not having an encyclopedia at home. And my parents were interested enough and knowledgeable enough to shuttle me over to the library to make sure that I did have access to an encyclopedia. But beyond that, I was at a significant disadvantage to the kids who had that at home. And today, the encyclopedia is the internet. That's nothing that's news to anybody in this room. The second place where I think in the classroom we may have an opportunity for substantial improvement and value added is in the area of materials. We talked about that a little bit. I have 30 seconds for the whole thing. Okay. Well, I'm going to take some of Rob's time. And then he can chime in. Because I yielded back some of my time I didn't do this in the introduction.
The rules as we go.
Well, you know, I learned from the speaker. This afternoon I'm meeting with some folks over at Rice University who have what they call an open textbook, open materials program in place. Their goal is mainly college-based materials, but they're also interested in working on K-12. We will be meeting with somebody from a company that I didn't know exists existed, but they are a company that writes the materials for the textbook publishers. And they are looking at getting around the roadblock. They see a lot of their value, they see a lot of the money that's being made in this industry being made by people other than them. And Rice sees a way to deliver course material very inexpensively if they only had the course material. So we're going to have some preliminary discussions about how they could possibly be involved in the state textbook adoption process, but you're talking about PDFs that would essentially be open source or very low cost compared to what we pay for textbooks. And now, as many of you I'm sure are aware, the availability of portable desktop publishing to the point that you could have devices in your school district or in your, you know, at your central administration that could generate 50 books if you decided you needed 50 hard copies and not pay for anything beyond what you needed. I think that has huge potential because we're spending, what, Rob, they're talking about $1 billion budget for reading textbooks in the next legislative session?
$700 million.
Well, you know, a few hundred million here or there. You know, with gas prices, it'll be $1 billion by the time we get them delivered to your schools and unpacked and moved around within your school districts. I want to talk briefly about the other side of the game, though, which is the compliance and accountability data that we spent huge amounts of time and huge amounts of money collecting. We've had the PEAM system in effect since before I was in the legislature. I'm not quite sure that anybody has ever taken any data directly out of PEAMs without having to have a lot of human intervention. I think in a lot of cases, the answer you get when you design a system depends on the question you ask to begin with. What is it that you're trying to accomplish? I have yet to find anybody who has gone to the teachers and the educational leaders in this state or in your school district and said, how can the state data help you? Or can it? That's what this is supposed to be all about. We're supposed to be delivering better education. So I think to the extent in whatever we do to redo PEAMS, and whatever we do to put that data together, to the extent that we can design it from the standpoint of a teacher in the classroom being able to use something or have some value in it, then we will have value in the system. If not, it's just a very big collection of stuff that we reach in and pull out the pieces that we need when we want to make a point that is, that supports whatever political agenda we happen to have. Secondly, even at doing that, we need to do a better job of it. I've been working with the E3 consortium up in Susan Dawson and Travis and Williamson, and just listening to the stories about, this is a business group that has gotten together and decided to help the schools, but they want data first. They have spent several years now just trying to get data out of TEA that would allow them to analyze the schools in their area. And they have found that to be an almost impossible job, and that when they finally do get the data, it's of questionable value because garbage in, garbage out. So we have serious issues there. And I'll just close it with the words of the superintendent of Spring Branch, who told me, yes, we go through and we provide all this data to the state, and I've got huge systems that we pay vendors a lot of money for, and then I've got my little laptop with an Excel spreadsheet that tells me the budget numbers that I need. So clearly there's a disconnect between what we're collecting and what is valuable.
Parker, Eisler, would you like to make a few additions to his comment? What's your vision?
In my reduced time,
you're senior to him, so you get more
time. I get
some.
You get it. I see how this works now.
This is the education.
The real question is, can Ed stop us? only if he makes an airplane out of those little signs.
The next thing about humans rather than computers is we don't have a plug.
Real fast, and I'll turn it over to Mark. To tag along with Scott's thoughts on data, I mean, he's right about the PEAMS business, and now, if you think there are turf battles in the school business, you can see it in the legislature. You know, we had a bill, for want of a better term, the TED bill, House Bill 2238, that got through and had a $200 million fiscal note, which means it was going to cost that much to clean up the data. Now, that should tell you, you know, what a great job a certain agency has been doing, taking care of the data, and we're looking at, in fact, guess who it went through to, for that fiscal year. So we could tell they were fighting it, and we almost passed the bill. There were a few things that happened at the end of the session that didn't enable us to get it completely through. But as Scott talked about, we do need cleaner data, we need timelier data. And what I'd like to see, you know, we're working on a new accountability system. You may have heard something about tax and end of course exams and a quicker, plainer, more effective, fairer accountability system that at least in my desire, is to have strong, accessible, well-timed data to make data-driven decisions and provide tools to school districts, because I think that's one of the most important things the state can do. And you know, the three R's that I'd like to end up with, at least on a district level, is you know, recognize the best practices, best districts, reward them, and then maybe a slightly different twist, especially in today's news, that third R is repair those that aren't performing. And we can do that with the data that Scott's going to help produce. So I think that's the end of the problem.
So I'm going to take Scott and Rob's time on the next question. No, actually, I'm going to take my own time for the next question to answer this one, because this is probably the only one I actually have a really strong opinion about. And the other ones, not knowing what the next questions are, I'm guessing I won't have strong opinions about. Because I don't get to deal with the day-to-day decision-making that they get to deal with in the present time, I get to think a lot about what I'd like schools to look like in 5 years. And I have pretty strong opinions about that. I would like to see, I walk into most classrooms today and I see a teacher standing in front of 30 kids, all of whom come to school with different levels of preparedness, some of whom had help on their homework last night, some of whom didn't, some of whom had a breakfast that morning, some of whom didn't. They are all going to learn at different speeds, and the teacher has to teach to the center of the bell curve. The teacher cannot individualize instruction to each of those kids. And then, and I think it is extraordinarily difficult in the time frame we've endeavored to do so far, to measure the effectiveness of the immersion pilot programs that we have. But one way of measuring them that I grant doesn't have a lot of scientific validity is to go and visit them. So I've gone and visited the intelligent classrooms in Round Rock ISD, and I've gone to visit Irving ISD, and I've gone to visit the New Tech High and Manor ISD. And here's what I see when I go to those classrooms. I see a teacher in the middle of the classroom who is engaging with each kid, and I see kids learning at their own pace in ways that work for them in an individualized fashion. And I don't know when it'll show up on test scores. For me at this point, it is an article of faith, because I can't prove that it will make a difference in learning. But it is an article of faith that it will. And I will guarantee you this. We will waste a lot of money, and we will do a lot of things wrong in the process of getting to the point where it materially makes a difference. Just as the private sector wasted a lot of money and did a lot of things wrong in the 90s at a time when the economy experienced revolutionary productivity growth because of the integration of technology into business processes. But I believe that we can eventually get it right, and I believe that it is the most revolutionary thing we can do in education. I don't know what the thin edge of the wedge is. I've spent a lot of time thinking about what is the killer app? What is the thing that if you build it, the rest of the educational system will follow? At first, I thought maybe it was making every campus, you know, have Wi-Fi. I kind of think that the appropriate role of the state on a five-year horizon is that we give you all these standards, things you have to teach, things kids have to learn before they can graduate. One of the greatest challenges we face is the variability and quality of education from classroom to classroom. Besides the variability and preparedness of kid and learning style of kid, we have the variability of teaching in each classroom. Why haven't we put online, using the best pedagogical practices, the best instructional content for every kid to learn everything we say they must learn. What? Why isn't that something that's relatively easy in a five-year time frame for the state to do, for us to provide it for free to not only every school in Texas, but every child, parent, anybody, anywhere in the state, anywhere in the world? If you want to know what you need to know to graduate from a public school in Texas, here's where you can learn it. And move the teacher from being a sage on the stage, as you know, used to say, being a guide by the side of each kid. The other thing we hear from teachers all the time is that they've become social workers. It may just be that that is an unavoidable consequence of the 21st century, and that the best thing we can do to unleash the power of teachers is to automate some of the instructional responsibilities they face so they can coach those kids into learning. I think that content is probably where the state's role is most important. I think if we do it in the right way, in a web-based delivery model that allows you guys to access that content through thin client, low total cost of ownership systems, that we can unleash your districts to see the potential of integrating more technology in their classroom and use it well. So that's my five-year horizon.
And you all do have a vision for technology for Texas. We really appreciate your vision. But we know that there's some challenges facing you all as legislators and our elected representatives. Talk about what are those challenges that are going to face you in this next legislative session, and maybe some ideas that you have about overcoming those challenges. And we'll start with Representative Eisler for this question. And they'll have about, I guess we can do about 5 minutes each.
I'll watch. I will, Ed. I promise. How many people are thinking money? That's true. And that is one. And yes, we are sitting in a surplus situation again. I've heard $10 billion. I've heard $17 billion. And it's probably somewhere in between. And all the calls on that money. You know, you've got human services, CHIP, Medicaid, reimbursement rates, cost of gas, insurance, you know, all the inflationary factors. And Scott is also on the school finance committee, and I'll let him comment about that kind of fix. But when you look at that, the good news is there is money there. And also, traditionally, as I mentioned before, the textbook money is now instructional material money. And how that gets into your hands for software and other technology gains is to be determined. And also, just to talk about data again, you know, the great transparency battle for government. And people say, put your checkbook online. You know, when I was on the school board, when the superintendent didn't want to give us the full story, he'd tell us everything. So you have, you see what I mean? Where you'd get a stack of information that was 3 inches thick. And I like to refer to that as hiding in plain sight. And when you hear, oh, hey, this group put their checkbook on, okay, you get your checkbook online. Now who's going to go through that? So we need to have a system where the data is useful, where you can use the data as a tool, something that you can improve yourself. It's something that Mark talked about in terms of, you know, understandable TEKS. And I know you all follow the State Board of Education very closely. We also have a hearing to get to the bottom of how that went with the English language and reading, because I guess science is coming next. Anyway, so the challenges ahead are obvious. And, you know, we can get more sophisticated as we get some of the basic things squared away. You know, some of the things we thought, you know, Texas led the nation in data gathering. But we've had complaints from all over the country from researchers that have trouble getting the data. And you know, the excuse has been FERPA, and maybe there's some other problems there. But I think just recently it's been announced that our data will become more available to the researchers, and we have some research centers. So hopefully the data will become more useful. Well, it's about time. And you know,
we need to go faster than we are. So those are the two biggest challenges, and I'll turn it over. Okay, I can do this one quickly. Three significant barriers. One is the one Scott cited. It's very hard to document that any spending in this area is going to materially make a difference in student learning at this point. That's a huge problem because you're competing for funds with, let's say we were going to spend a lot of money on technology and education or propose to do so. You would have to compare that to the cost of a significant pay raise for teachers across the system, which would materially improve student learning, or to the cost of significantly reducing student class sizes, which would materially improve student learning, or to the cost of extending the school year by 10 or 15 days, which would materially improve student learning. So you've got to make a business case for the investment in technology against some significantly good ways to spend money. That is a huge obstacle. The other obstacle, I think, and it relates to this problem, is that the cost right now is higher than I think it needs to be. And Alice and I were talking about this, and Irving is doing some very creative stuff to try to figure this out. At the Texas Public Education Reform Foundation convention a year and a half ago, Rob and I got to meet afterward with Michael Dell. And I asked him, why does a school need a $1,500 machine, 90% of which 90% of computer users don't use? And why can't we do most of the computing that your students need through a thin client that ought to cost a fraction of what most schools have to spend on hardware today? And, you know, I don't know as much about computer manufacturing as Michael Dell does, and the answer was something about every tweak to the chip design is $1 billion off the top of the line before you start to manufacture it, and maybe that's right. But it just seems to me that we've got to find lower cost models of delivering what we can, and that also probably extends not just to the hardware but to the software side of things as well.
Great suggestions. We ought to have discussions like this in the legislature once in a while. three challenges. We have the money. We have had the money to do almost whatever we choose to do over the last few years. We've been blessed with budget surpluses that I never saw in the first 10 years I served in the legislature. We have absolutely zero willingness amongst the leadership of the state to spend it on anything other than writing checks back primarily to large corporations for tax relief. And so even coming into a session where we have whatever the surplus turns out to be, all agencies have already been asked to cut their budgets by 10% as a starting point. And, I mean, that goes for the agencies of education as well. It goes for the agencies of higher education. And it's regardless of the fact that that's 10% net. That's not 10% per kid. That's not 10%. It's regardless of the fact that we're educating more people in higher ed, that we have more kids going to our public schools. So we have a real attitudinal issue, a real philosophical issue at the core of the discussions we've been having for the last few years. And, you know, when you start in a situation where 6 years ago we started seeing a surplus and the proposal was made, can we somehow come to an agreement on divvying this up between the additional investments we know we need to make in education and tax relief? And the only answer I could get out of the administration or that any of us got was, yes, we can divvy it up 100% for tax relief, 0% for education. That's sort of a non-starter in negotiations. Secondly, we are siloed like you wouldn't believe. And I have, again, yet to be able to find anybody at a high enough level of state government to say, we need to be results-oriented, we need to have accountability the same way we expect y'all to have accountability, and break those silos down. And, I mean, I'll give you, indulge me in just a small example. UT System, after many years of a lot of us asking, has finally put on their website a neat little tool that will show any parent what their expected cost of sending their child to any UT school will be net of financial, of expected financial aid. Or if you put your income in there, you put your status, you put some very simple information, and you get a rough guess, this is what it's actually going to cost you. Tremendously valuable tool, A, for the parent who wants to plan in advance, but B, for the parent whose kid gets to high school and they say, oh my gosh, I can't afford it. Well, yes, you can, Mom, because look at the financial aid we're going to be able to get. The immediate question is, can we do this for the other schools? Can UT make it available to the other schools? It has been several years that we've had this discussion. I was told last week that we finally may have an agreement. But what was holding it up? Well, the other universities didn't want to give their financial aid information to University of Texas. They were insisting to give it to the Higher Education Coordinating Board as the neutral party. The Coordinating Board's IT people said, this is written in natural and in Flash, and we can't handle that, so you have to rewrite it in a different language. And we're not going to pay you to rewrite it in a different language. All of this over a project that I think if I took any table of y'all and put you in a room for a day, you could do the darn thing. This isn't really hard. But the silos get in the way. Third, the people in this room, and I will put myself in that as a technology person, do a really, really lousy job of selling what it is we do. I can't think of a more boring presentation to the legislature than a presentation given by technology people about what their technology can do in the schools, and I can't think of anything that should be more exciting. We're sitting here listening to Mark talking about how this technology gets kids excited. And yet, we are really hard-pressed to make that case to my colleagues. And so, if there's anything I can leave you with is, when y'all are thinking outside the box, and you're thinking about talking to your legislators, and talking to your superintendents, and talking to TASA, forget that you're a technology person and think that you're a vendor for a while. And I don't mean a technology vendor. You know, go out and sell the sizzle. Go out and show people what the end result is, not how many gigs of RAM you have in a particular box. And that will help us tremendously.
We're terabytes now, I think. You know, Alice, do you mind if I make one comment about silos before we move on? We have a lot of different sized school districts in Texas with different capacities. To me, I talked about a vision 5 years from now where every kid is receiving individualized instruction that is automated and meets their needs and measures their progress and all of those things. But in a much shorter term, it seems to me that we have the ability to solve the challenge that every first-year teacher faces, trying to figure out what they're going to teach tomorrow. And I have visited enough school districts to see, and I ask when I visit, if I was a sub tomorrow in a ninth grade English class, how would I know what to teach? Because it is just phenomenal to me that they have to figure that out, that we reinvent the wheel in every classroom, every day, every year. And some of the school districts have great online solutions for that teacher. And some of them couldn't possibly develop that themselves. How could they? They don't have those kinds of resources. Not many school districts here raised their hands when Keith asked if y'all are from small school districts, but ask them what they have in the way of online support for their teachers. It's just impossible for them. That's a resource we ought to be providing at the state. That's a silo we need to break through.
What I'm afraid of is that we are, but nobody can find it on the TEA website.
Well, you know what? We have a statute that says we're supposed to, and I've dug all through the TEA website, and I've asked the staff there to help me find it, and there's a little bit there so that they nominally comply with that statute, but it is not what you would expect.
A lot of it's hidden in plain sight.
This reminds me of when I put something in the appropriations bill that said that on TOX, when we were doing TOX instead of TOS, that there should be more open-ended questions because it used to be all multiple choice. They complied with that. If you notice, every TOX test now has one open-ended question, which is more than zero.
and that's name, right?
Yeah.
And there's a...
By the way, there's one obstacle, there's one barrier to adoption that we didn't mention, and that is the fear of technology as a home for predators. And that is I will say, I have been to places where the controls on access to the internet are so strict that to protect kids from the dangers of the internet, that I watched a group project, and I was in a school near my neighborhood, which means that some of my friends in this room, it was in our school district, guys, and a kid, they were doing a great group project. They were learning about, they were doing group projects about people who exemplify various words.
So they couldn't keep a breath.
Had to exemplify the word. They couldn't keep a what?
Keep a breath.
They had to exemplify the word loyalty. And these two fifth graders happened to be wearing baseball jerseys, wanted to do Craig Biggio. Couldn't get to him on the internet. I have no idea what about Craig Biggio would trigger the blockers, but they could not find a website that talked about Craig Biggio because of those protections. I know why parents are afraid of the dangers of the internet, but I do think we've got to err on the side of information.
And you know, we almost, one of the things, and it's not technology directly related, but that I'm most proud of in my legislative career was providing for school districts to be able to do dropout recovery programs for young adults up to the age of 26. And when we made the age change last year, what almost stopped that from happening was fear of predators, was fear that there would be significant numbers of young men who would sign up and go to these classes strictly for the purpose of finding 14-year-old girls that they could molest. And
or younger teachers.
But that almost stopped that bill in its tracks, which is why there's a kind of a strange provision in it that says they can't use the cafeteria or something like that. But we're not always making decisions based on big picture.
Thank you all for the comments for that last question. Now I'd like to open this up to our audience participation, and we'll walk around with a microphone.
By the way, has everybody read the Disruptive Innovation article? It's by Clayton Christensen and Michael Horn. Christensen is a Harvard Business School professor and talks about the difference in product development and where, for example, why RCA failed in its vacuum tubes and Sony was able to take them over with the less efficient, lower powered transistor, and talks about that in education terms. And that's a good thing to read if you're in the technology business, because it's the consumers of nothing which will take over a lot of the the market share. It talks about pharmaceutical, how they've changed. You know, where it used to be they used to call on doctors, and now they don't, because doctors don't have the time to see them, the sales reps. So where do you see the pitches for those new drugs? Directly to you, the consumer. So it's that kind of thing, and it discusses that, and it's a very readable article, and it's in Education Next, summer 2008, and it's how do we transform our schools. And you probably Google disruptive innovation. Anyway, while you're...
Who has a question? Don't be afraid, y'all talked a lot yesterday.
I have my BlackBerry, you'd like to text it to me.
Thank you guys for being here. This is by far the best seminar I've ever seen, where legislators have gotten together. You guys get it. You guys get it. I hope everybody in the room has really witnessed what we've been able to hear today. What is it that, since you guys get it, what is it that you can't get done with your ideas? Where are your roadblocks? I mean, you've got a surplus. Where is it?
I thought I answered that.
Scott hit that.
that he was right. And the political pressures are there. You know, does anybody here have a school district that is not tight on the budget? You know, it used to be you had a one-year grace period, you know, with the property value you could use that increase, especially the Houston area, or fast growth areas. And now the state would take your gain the next year, which would drive tax rates up. And because they were limited to $1.50, $1.50, Scott, not $1.54. No, right. inside joke. So now it's set up to where the state gets the money right away, and that's part of the surplus. And I know the system was designed for, you know, rollback elections to take money past the four gold pennies. And I know Scott's working on that that committee to fix that. And again, the long story short, it's too late. it's the political process. You remember, a camel is a horse designed by a committee.
But seriously, folks, there. I don't want to put my Republican colleague too far out on a limb on this, but I think Mark would certainly agree with me that the philosophy of our government right now is to reduce spending, to reduce taxes, to let school districts sort of fend for themselves, and so it is very hard to have discussion about new initiatives. It really, really is. And ultimately, the governor signs the budget bill. Ultimately, the governor gets to veto any line in the budget bill. So that's one problem. The second problem is all of these agencies the state government operates through executive agencies. They all have their own agendas. So when we come in and say, hey, we got this great idea, why don't you go do this? It's kind of like a teacher coming to you and saying, I got a great idea, can you give me this tomorrow? And you say, well, excuse me, how does that fit amongst the technology plan that we adopted 2 years ago and that I've been, you know, very carefully working on? None of these things are overnight things. So we can order TEA to straighten their data up, and they'll say, yeah, see you in the next lifetime. You know, or we're working on it, or we're going to get there.
But we're not working on it.
Or we're not working on it, but how can you tell?
And the entrenched stakeholdership is not just bureaucratic. There are financial interests that have
yes.
that have done things the same way a long time and made money doing it. And disruptive change is a threat to them too.
And no, and again, back to this concept of who are we asking to validate what we're doing? No teacher group has ever come to the legislature in my time and said, "Give us more computers as our high priority." No administrator group has done that. No school board group has done that. Now, there are districts coming and saying, increase the technology a lot. But in my view, that's primarily because they're spending more than they're getting from the state that's dedicated to technology, and we'll pay them more money dedicated to technology. It becomes fungible. They can then go pay for their increased gasoline costs, etc. If they can do that by leveraging technology, they're gone. But there is no real advocacy for this except for vendors. And vendors, with apologies to everybody in the room, are suspect. Because vendors are coming to sell us their package.
But they are excited about their technology.
But they are excited about their technology.
But they're not always the lowest cost way for us to deliver what you need.
Right. And when I go knocking door to door, and I don't know about your district, because you've got a higher tech district than I do, and you may have a higher tech, you probably have a higher. Nobody, I can't remember ever knocking on the door of a constituent who said to me, Hopford, when are you going to get more computers in the schools? Or when are you going to fix the data problem at the EA?
Other questions from the audience? Ed.
Ed wants to know when we're going to pay attention to his sign.
We apologize, Ed.
No, actually, the dialogue has been, the dialogue has been absolutely sensational. So, I think that was as important as his timing. Yesterday, though, we did hear a presentation on long-tail learners, the idea of the long tail, and that as you go out to niche groups, which, again, I think we do have a lot of niche learners out there. But one of the theories of the long tail is to digitize your resources and then centralize your inventory. Mark, you actually had talked about that in terms of a statewide type of system, but yet the public school system in Texas is set up as independent school districts. Mm-hmm. Yes, the question is how can we move in that direction to become much more efficient? Right now, we basically create our own resources for our own independent school districts, and yet we know we could be much more efficient if we did it at a higher level, regional, state level.
So why don't you?
Why don't you
have service centers. Everybody, you know, everybody in here is in a service center region. Everybody in here has access to various co-ops.
I'll tell you why.
And what is it that we at the state level prevent you from doing, that prevents you from sharing it with him or her or somebody else? Why do you, and while I would agree that, yes, some leadership from the state would be helpful, why the whole concept of computers is distributed?
As an example, not to put the onus or blame on you, it happens a lot of places. In fact, we had the commissioner of TEA as a witness, and Scott asked him about the inspector general's report on how to do a better job on awarding contracts. And I think there were 9 recommendations that were basically recommendations for the legislature to maybe put in statute. But you know, as you know, every 2 years, so we had another year before anything of that would happen, and they were all good ideas, essential ideas. And Scott asked the commissioner, of these 9 recommendations, how many have you implemented? Because you don't need the legislature to make you do that. You can do that ahead of time on your own. Guess what the answer was? Zip. Okay? That's why we're having another meeting, by the way, or 2 or 3. But we did put in, and I forget which bill it was, the opportunity for school districts to combine common services, I think. Food service purchasing, transportation, maintenance, and I can never get the 5th one off the top of my head. Personnel, maybe. But again, school districts don't do that because they don't have to. It's like best practices. How often do you look up the web page of best practices? And the reason is you don't need to. You don't have to. I mean, it'd be nice, but you're busy doing what you're doing. And that's why I want to put some of that into the accountability, not as a nasty must-have, but an opportunity for school districts to improve themselves. And they'll find that as one of the ways to do that. When you look at efficiency and you look at data-driven decisions and where money is best spent, districts will find that on their own. Because you know better than the legislature. You know better how to do what you do more efficiently than we do. And you know, we provide those pathways, but they're not always taken. And I think that's something that we'll see in the future, and you will do it.
And I don't mean to come off as flip. It's a serious question. Both the questions are serious. My question to you is there something we're doing at the state level that prevents you from engaging in collaboration, that discourages you from that? Or do you have your attorney saying, we can't do this for this reason? If those things are occurring, please bring them to us.
Can I jump in on that? I got a good idea from you just now.
Yeah, I mean, we made, I think some, I remember going to a textbook coordinators association meeting a number of years ago, and there were a lot of questions about, why don't you do this way, and this way, and this way? I said, because we've never heard those questions. And we fixed a bunch of the issues that they had with the way we were doing things at the state level simply by collecting those, putting them in a bill, getting them behind it, and passing it. So to the extent that there are things that are getting in your way that are preventing you from doing what you logically see that either the state ought to do or you ought to, if we're not going to do it, y'all can do, please tell us what those are.
Here's an example of Representative Harper.
Sure.
The state has just put out the Vision 2020 grant, which part of that grant is going to address the virtual school. I know TEA is working this past week to make decisions on the finalists for that grant. But as we were talking about how is that going to be implemented, it's very difficult for them right now to come up with some answers because of the way schools are typically funded right now. We're funded on ADA, a student being in a seat. And if we're talking about virtual schools where the student may be in another district and are using my teachers to get their instruction, what is it that we can do at the state level to loosen up some of those barriers of getting funding for districts when they're doing a situation like online learning?
Well, first of all, the bill that Chairman Madden worked on that specified the virtual school situation, I think, was very specific at how those money transfers were going to occur. So if the agency is having trouble with that, that's something we need to ask the agency about, and we need to hear about it. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. Second, I don't know of much that can't be done through interlocal agreement, assuming that you have willing parties on both sides, and y'all have to come to some agreement about how much of the cost you're sustaining and how much they're sustaining. I can think of one place where you get hung up, and that would be who gets the accountability for the kid. I would argue that that's probably the last thing you should be worried about, because if you're really worried about delivering education, I'm not quite sure I care whose tax report they get on, as long as they're not on both. And we had a situation in where one school district was trying to pass some stuff where they both get credit for the kid, and that probably didn't work very well. It probably didn't work with the feds. But again, get us some specifics. You can do it any time. It doesn't have to be at this meeting. It doesn't have to be formal. You have people I think any member of the Public Education Committee and members who and local representatives who aren't are very interested in hearing about things that present roadblocks for no other reason other than a bureaucrat won't get out of the way.
Go ahead, Martin. I got to throw something in on there. I think Scott is onto something really powerful. But I don't think, because of the reasons Rob talks about, that y'all have the ability necessarily to create this elaborate system of interlocal agreements and best practices sharing, but without a little bit of help from us. But what if, to go to that idea I talked about of just having the best practices available for every teacher and figure out what they're going to teach tomorrow, what if we created at the state level essentially a wiki that allowed you guys to share that stuff with each other, that had a good system of rating user-generated content so that the best stuff, the stuff that the users of the system find most useful, does rise to the top, and that it's easy to search and it's easy to find and it's easy to use? I mean, Rob's right. You're not going to do a lot of things that aren't required of you in an atmosphere where you're required to do so many things, unless those things that are not required of you make the things that are required of you easier to do. Unless that the practical utility of those things is so great that you say, I'm not going to school tomorrow until I have looked up this wiki that tells me all the best things I could do with my time while I'm there, that makes my job easier and that makes my lesson planning easier and that reduces my workload in a significant way. And that actually seems to me to be some infrastructure that at a relatively modest investment the state could create and allow and unleash the power of all of the thousand flowers blooming in our public schools and let you guys share best practices.
I'll tell you right now what their objection will be. I got one right off the bat.
Go ahead.
Not their objection, yeah. TEA's objection. Well, if it's on a TEA-sponsored server, and if it's not the best stuff, and if some legislator or parent complains about what's on there, then we're going to have to take the responsibility for it because they won't understand open source. And
trust their users. I agree they're going to have that objection, and that objection is totally wrong.
And something we do as legislators, we have to get out of the habit of, and most of it is because we're in such a hurry to get through the process. I think each bill has 42 steps that it has to overcome to pass. So, and of course, everything gets compressed at the end of the session. So what do we write in the legislation when we have this great idea and this great program? Is we put rulemaking in the TEA. And guess what happens there? By the time they make the rules, it doesn't look like the bill we passed. So I think you've seen that. So, And then also, if we have this wonderful best practices website, as you said, that's the same group that's watching the data that isn't helping you right now. So I agree with you that we need to find, and I have some ideas that I'm not making public because I'm afraid I'll get shot. So at the right time, we will, so that I'll get shot at the right time, too. But we are aware of this problem, and we are aware of this disconnect, and we are looking to fix it.
I'm Julie Wallace, and I'm from Birdville ISD, which is the school district right next to Fort
Worth.
Home of Bob Reese. That's right.
That's right. Yes.
My desk mate.
And Kelly.
No. And Kelly Hancock.
Kelly Hancock.
And Kelly. That's right. Yes, Kelly was on our board, and I've been with the district for 5 years. Here's my question, and I've got a couple of points to make. One is, come and visit my school district, and you'll see some really exciting things. And I agree with you that we don't do a good job in marketing. And I constantly work with my staff to try to work on doing a better job. The other thing, and I know you all are aware of this, and I know everyone in the room probably, as you were speaking, we're all thinking about this deeply. In 2005, we said our motto was "Stay Alive," till 2005. And we did that, and now it's 2008, and we just passed our budget, and we were $6 million in the hole, and we went ahead and gave a raise, but we took money out of savings. And this next year, there will be no raise, and in October, we'll start making cuts. We say that maybe next fall, we can say, let's go out for a election and raise taxes and get that money, and that'll help us for a year or two. And then we're trying to take open enrollment. We've got about 100 kids from some of the private schools to come to our high schools. We've got a little money there. And then we've just been scrubbing the budget. We know in October we're going to come up with a plan, and the board has asked us to come forward and show them the cuts that we can make. We've already cut as many teachers as we could, and we've already got the classrooms as full as we can. So I guess in our minds, I don't know how many of you, is anybody else in here kind of in that boat where you're... That's what I thought. All I'm saying is everyone in the room, as we were all talking, we want to have a vision, but I'll be honest, we're all feeling this doom and gloom in a way, because honestly, in 3 years, we're going to be broke.
Okay, I'm going to respond to that in two ways. And, you know, we're all friends here, right? This is. I've talked a couple of times about how. I mean, I have heard the Speaker of the House say schools don't need any more money. I've heard him say that.
Recently?
That, yes. That's been his attitude for many, many years. I knew the man for a long time before he became Speaker. That's his philosophical direction. I have heard members of the leadership say, it is our job at the legislature to cut taxes, it is your job as school board members to raise the minimum money. That being said, I will also tell you honestly that having been doing this since 1993, I have come into many rooms over that period of time and heard somebody, usually near the end of the discussion, say exactly what you just said. That we have already scrubbed everything over the, you know, we thought we had it 2 years ago, but now we've really scrubbed it. That we're going to be broke in 2 years or 3 years. And while at some point that may be accurate, I believe only one or two school districts have gone into financial shutdown over the entire time I've been in the legislature, and in those cases there was pretty well-documented malfeasance. So I think that it becomes very easy for us and my colleagues to, as they say in the investment world, discount what you're saying. Because we've heard it before, and the sky has never actually fallen in. Now what we're not seeing is, yes, but performance is falling behind. We're not, you know, we're using gimmicks to get our top scores up, et cetera, et cetera. That's very different from the schools are closed.
And so on the one hand, I agree, sympathize, and I think every member, I know every member of this panel has worked very hard to deal with the financial issues. And we've lost. We've lost those political battles. But on the other hand, I think the case is not well made. It's not made in a way that really resonates and sounds any different from the folks over in Medicaid, who clearly are short funded, the folks in higher ed who have funding challenges. I read an audit report yesterday that we're 9 years behind on the computer system for the parole division of TDCJ. So you just become part of the rest of the stack, and you're a part that's very hard to move because you're 50% of the entire state. You're 50% of what we have to spend that isn't federally dedicated. Moving you a little bit costs a huge amount. So I'm not telling you to give up, but I'm telling you to make your case better in terms of, hey, if we had this, here's what you could expect this to produce.
The only thing I'd add, everything he said is right. And he's been dealing with it much longer than me, and he actually sits at the table when those decisions are getting made. But I have also observed, besides the leadership he referred to, I've observed the Governor's Business Council's messaging on this. And what they say is that if there are a bunch of CEOs, big businesses, who believe that the public schools are frivolous with money, that if y'all just ran your schools the way they run their businesses, we could do much more with much less money. And that is their belief. So the correct response, I believe, is that there are lessons to be learned from the private sector in the delivery of public education. But you don't compare public education to any industry in the private sector. You don't compare it to widget manufacturing because children aren't widgets. If you want to learn lessons from the private sector that can be applied to public education, the lesson should be drawn from the private education marketplace. That's the most similar industry. If you want to learn lessons from the private education marketplace, what is the first lesson you learn?
Spend a heck of a lot more money than we're spending.
There is a direct correlation between quality and money in the private education marketplace.
You don't even have to go that far, Mark. You can go to KIPP. You can go to YES.
That's right.
And you can see the additional expenditures that are made, not through state money, but because they're able to leverage private contributions. The number I heard the other day was $1,500 a kid additional.
The lesson of the private marketplace,
even some of the Chapter 40,
directly contradicts the lesson of the Governor's Business Council that says you could do more with less if you ran it like a business. The lesson of the private marketplace is that it takes money to educate kids in today's environment.
And another lesson, and we're bringing the GBC around. We've talked to them openly and privately about, you know, how their attitude has probably hurt the battle. But there are things that the business does use for efficiency and productivity that schools don't, and that's not the school's fault. And again, it comes back to management tools, management training. You know, you look at who's the key player in the management of a school is a principal. You know, do we go out of our way to make sure they have the latest training, the best training for management, for dealing with teachers, for delivering their service? No, we don't. Now we've got a couple of principal academies coming up. I think UT has one and somebody else. So and Houston too. So we in the legislature see that, and we're working on that. And the big thing we're looking at is providing those tools for school districts to run better. And also to look within themselves, as Scott mentioned, you know better than the state knows on what you should be doing and maybe where you can economize and where you can invest more. And that's what we want to do. We want to optimize the way good businesses do our delivery of service so that you can do a better job, we can help you do a better job rather than just sit here and demand it and keep taking away. So I think you'll see a better partnership.
Just remember when somebody says to you, when are schools going to be the next Federal Express, that Federal Express did not do something that other people were already doing at a lower price. Federal Express said,
we're going to offer much greater service than anybody has been able to provide, but we're going to charge you a whole bunch more for it, and we think you're willing to pay for it.
And we are.
And that's the piece that has not got the process working.
We want to thank you all so much for being with us
today.
We have really appreciated the comments, and also that we accept your challenges, and thank you for the comments about getting us more involved and selling our story better, because I think all of us here in the audience will start to do that with our legislative representatives. Hang on for just a second. Marianne and Harold, would y'all come up and help me do a little award? And we are a little over time, so where are we on the schedule? So take a very quick break and then get to your next clinic about, so we'll start at 10 and we'll start coming into that first one.